the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. That was Sarita singing Sonny and Frank Sinatra saying, "Here's Johnny." The night as I was his guest on The Tonight Show. It's Monday, October 16th. We're live from Las Vegas, which, with the recent massacre, some people are saying on Facebook, may be the new Dallas with slot machines. I will get to that in a moment, and shortly to one of the most interesting guests I have ever had on this show, the gifted producer of a long-suppressed, insightful documentary called Trump, What's the Deal? But what a week, and a few quick observations about that week from the White House to Hollywood and, of course, to my hometown, Las Vegas. While in Hollywood, I observed firsthand and worked with a number of Harvey Weinsteins using and coercing women for sex, but sex was secondary for them. It's the same affliction with the Mega Billionaires Club, which owns America, a club to which George Carlin said, "You and I don't belong. Sex or money is not their orgasm. Power is. Control is. And Trump is losing it." The proof with Weinstein is a number of times he's had to pay a $100,000 settlement to an actress or a model when all he had to do was get a $1,000 hooker. Now he just committed himself to a sex therapy clinic in Arizona and has already offered movie contracts to three nurses, all of whom accepted. I want to thank the scores of my better informed Facebook friends for their remarkably informative videos they are sending me regarding last week's monstrous massacre here. If you're also one of my friends, I urge you to go to my Facebook page and watch and listen to two massively important videos. One is a gun-loving survivor who tells Jeff Rentz with calmness and clarity his experience trying to save his wife and her friends, claiming shots were fired at ground level from behind them as they fled at what he thought was a construction site. The second video is from a forensic specialist with audio analysis, which may just prove that. As one who's watched as much as possible of live reporting from the incident it happened here in town, it is obvious from law enforcement and media we are getting conflicting information. Facts are being suppressed. Our hotels have more security cameras than they have chips. Where is the footage of Paddock? It reeks of 911 in the Pentagon. Where are the ballistics tests showing the victims were hit by one of Paddock's guns? If you've watched Sheriff Lombardo, who is really trying to do his job, you can see him immediately emotionally disintegrating before our eyes. And that's because I think the moment he said publicly Paddock had to have help, the FBI moved in and said, no, it was only Paddock. And not only that, the FBI asking the public for help confiscated thousands of their cell phones with video and audio and returned them all deleted. Press conferences are now closed to alternative media sources. This is not an investigation. This is a cover-up of what and why we may never know. Now, ISIS is taking credit for this, but this is not a terrorist act. All terrorism, all political terrorism has announced political purpose. When we were terrorists creating this country against the English, we didn't keep it a secret. We wanted taxation with representation. When Mao Zedong was perpetrating terrorism against us in Chiang Kai-shek, he didn't keep it a secret. And neither did Mao Zedong when he committed terrorism against the French and us. or the Palestinians being called terrorists because they're trying to make reference to the fact that their land has been stolen and they want it back. There has been no announcement from ISIS for the purpose of this senseless slaughter from London to Las Vegas, and it won't be solved with government trying to solve it. There should be a special investigative committee set up by the president that includes qualified civilians to join law enforcement, which brings me to media. As an aside, I would like to thank the thousands of you who have bought and watched and reviewed on Amazon and video our documentary, The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, which seems to be getting more topical and more relevant every day. In particular, I want to thank Mark Crispin Miller, a best-selling author and professor of media at New York University. I want to thank Mark for two reasons. One, he is the only media professor in the country showing his students our film about media, and one of the few prominent figures interested in the truth who is recommending the film constantly. And the other reason I wish to thank Mark is for recommending our amazing guest tonight. I love everything this highly creative, original filmmaker has done. She was the first in America to critique media on television while at PBS. It's baseball playoff time. The only time I watched that very boring game, made all the more interesting by her insightful documentary about baseball inside and out. And having been a film critic for over 10 years, she made a classic about a classic, The Making of Casablanca. But now she has topped all that with her most important work, a most urgent look at the man on the very hot seat in the Oval Office, her devastating documentary film, Trump, What's the Deal? She made 25 years ago, suppressed till just recently by Trump with threats of lawsuits. It is a delight to know that this film can now be streamed for you to see, and a real honor to welcome the filmmaker, producer, Libby Andros. Libby, welcome to the show, and thank you for being here, and where are you?
Thank you so much for that lovely and generous introduction. And I just wanted to add to what you were talking about in your introduction, where they took away people's cell phones and they were brought back to them, erased clean. Remember when Bobby Kennedy was shot, they went around and they confiscated all the cameras and people could not get their cameras back, let alone their photos.
Yes,
so there
I remember.
You go. They repeat what they're doing.
I was on the committee to save Thomas Noguchi his job, along with his lawyer, and we spoke to thousands of people in L.A., and the purpose was to keep a politically independent coroner in office. And the story of how he eventually lost his job, I detail in my book. It's very, very sad. To this day, I still have communication with him, and I have hanging in my bedroom a wonderful painting. His hobby was painting, and he gave me a painting which I hang in my bedroom. And when you're back on the show again, and I know you're going to be back on the show again, we will get into that in much more detail. But what I would like you to do, first of all, and I do this with every guest, and I hate doing it because I'm repeating myself, but where were you born? What was your family like? Did you have siblings? What did you want to be when you were a young girl? And how on earth did you end up becoming the filmmaker that you became?
Well, actually, I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm a bit of a corporate brat. My father was a lawyer for a major corporation, and so we moved around a bit. So we went from Louisville to Arizona, Phoenix in the 60s, which doesn't resemble Phoenix at all today. It was a small, you know, desert oasis in the mid-60s. And then finally we made our way back to New York City, where I basically grew up in the suburbs of New York City. And I guess, you know, I'm of an age where Watergate was a big story. And, you know, came to find out certain things about that later on, but Woodward and Bernstein were heroes. And I wanted to be a journalist, and I started working for a local newspaper, and then I got involved in making films and decided it was much more fun to tell a story with pictures. So that's what kind of brought me to where I am today.
And now you did a documentary about Trump 25 years ago, and that was about the time, wasn't that about the time you were on PBS talking about media?
We had just actually, so our weekly show, which was called Inside Story, and it was anchored by Hodding Carter, who was the former State Department spokesman during the Iranian hostage crisis. And if you remember, every night during that crisis, Ted Koppel and Hodding Carter would come on, and they did a show called The World Held Hostage. When the hostages yes. finally came home, Ted Koppel went on to do Nightline, and Hodding went to do Inside Story. And so we did that for four seasons. And after we lost our funding from a major corporation for that, we started doing long-form independent films. The Trump film was actually the pilot for what was supposed to be a syndicated series on celebrity businessmen. You have to go back to the late 80s. And that's suddenly when celebrity businessmen became big. You had Lee Iacocca. You had Rupert Murdoch. You had all these, you know, Donald Trump. And so this was the pilot for what was going to be a whole series on celebrity businessmen. But, you know, because Donald suppressed it, we never got beyond Donald.
Well,
you also have to remember.
Hello?
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. I cut you off.
No, you didn't. I was just going to say, first of all, that would have been an enormously, enormously interesting and must-watch television series. However, from what I've seen of your documentary, it looked like you would have savaged Lee Iacocca and you would have savaged Rupert Murdoch and any other biggie who was making unnecessary millions of dollars. I mean, it is staggering. It is staggering. And I'll tell you what shocked me. There were a number of things that shocked me. First of all, the terrific information about the workers he hired, the conditions, what he paid them or didn't pay them. But
the Polish Brigade, those poor immigrants who took down the old Bonwit Teller building to make way for Trump Tower, they worked in absolutely deplorable conditions, stripping the asbestos out of that building. And in fact, at one point in time, there was so much labor strife on the building, Donald was afraid he was going to be thrown off the building, literally.
Well, obviously, Libby, if you were making this for a pilot, you couldn't have started thinking, or maybe you knew something that nobody else knew, but you couldn't have started off thinking, I'm going to do an investigation into this guy and reveal his personality and unravel his finance. You couldn't have been thinking that.
Well, interestingly, when we started the film, very, very early on, I was at an event and I was talking to somebody about what we were doing. And as an aside, the guy said to me, you know, Donald's not worth as much money as he says he is. And this is before he went bankrupt the first time. And I thought the guy was nuts. But I, you know, started to ask some people and I thought, okay. So every time we did an interview, the very last question we would ask people is, do you think Donald's really worth as much money as he says he is? Well, when Donald found out that question was being asked, he absolutely hit the roof. And that's what really kind of did our film. And not the fact that he was afraid we might figure out that he was having an affair with Marla Maples, because that all broke in the midst of us making the film. And we had decided, actually, that there was enough about Donald's business practices that we didn't need to go into the bedroom. To do a journalistically sound film, we did not have to go into the bedroom.
Well, didn't he at one time take somebody to court who said he was not a billionaire and lost the suit?
He did. He took Tim O'Brien years later in the late 90s. Tim O'Brien, who had been a research assistant on Wayne Barrett's book about Donald Trump, and then went to work for the New York Times as a business writer, and he's now, I think, got a senior editorial job at Bloomberg. He took Tim O'Brien to court, and he lost. Yes, it's a sealed agreement.
When you were doing the Trump story, there were a lot of things that were shocking and unknown to me, and I'll get to one of them a little later. But as you were getting into the story and learning about his business practices, did your impressions about this blonde-haired genius change when it came to the content of his character or even his intelligence?
I think that fairly early on, we knew that, to use a cliche, the king really had no clothes. Very early on, we did interview Tony Schwartz, who ghost wrote or actually he's named as the writer with Donald on his first book, The Art of the Deal. And so we kind of knew that there was a lot of puffery. And even though Donald was always in the headlines, if you started to scratch beneath the headlines, you'd start to find out that there was a lot of puffery there. Or, you know, as he used to call it, creative hyperbole.
Well, you know, there's a story going around town here about Steve Wynn when they built something at Treasure Island or one of his hotels where they had a massive display of pirates fighting. And he had contracted with a first firm. It was going to be their first job. And he never paid them. To this day, they never got paid. There are a lot of horror stories in town about Steve Wynn, but they don't like to talk about them. And that book about him was also suppressed. What were some of the shocking things you learned about his business's practices?
I think the fact that he really didn't pay people the money they were owed, I think that that's just outrageous. I think that if people do a job for you and they do it well, they should get paid what they're owed. And particularly, it's the story of the Woolman Rink, and that's really the place where Donald was kind of made a hero. You know, there's the Woolman Rink sitting in the middle of Central Park. It's, you know, sitting, unused. It's a prime example of government not being able to do what government should be able to do. They've tried to, you know, fix it and renovate it and get it going, and it's a blight. And Donald comes along and says, I'll fix it for free and on time. Well, as we found out, he got paid, but he's got all the people who worked on it to give their labor to it. And what did they get? You know, he got all the glory, and what did they get? They got the bills. And I think that's really kind of outrageous.
And also, is it true that a lot of these workers were handling dangerous pipes and electrical lines?
That was the Polish Brigade who did the dismantling of Trump Tower. I mean, of the old Bonwit Teller building to make way for Trump Tower. Yes, they were not given the right protective clothing. They were handling raw pipes. They were handling asbestos, and they had none of the correct safety precautions whatsoever. And, you know, it's only you realize that if you do something right, the amount of money involved is so little. So it really goes to the heart of somebody's character that they would treat people that way. And Donald likes to say he's for the little man. And, you know, when he was running for president, and I didn't, you know, the film was suppressed a second time. We got a lot of, you know, internet attention, but the major media basically ignored the film. And you have to wonder, you know, why weren't all these things about Donald Trump that are out there put out there for people to see when he announced he was running for president during the campaign? I mean, that's an interesting question.
Well, it's an absolutely terrific question. And, you know, to this day, like I said, Trump is losing it. What he is losing, I think, is the fact that he has come to finally realize that he does not run the country. John Kennedy realized it with the gunshots to the front of his head. I think every president since then knows that he does not run the country, and probably Trump is not used to that. And I see him saying some really tasteless and classless things. He was probably elected because he was not Hillary Clinton. He was probably elected because he was not part of that Eastern Club. And I can well understand that, okay? But what is shocking to me is the often tasteless things he says. First of all, from saying he never reads, which means he might not have ever read the Constitution. John Kennedy not only read, but he wrote books, for crying out loud, as did a lot of presidents, but not Donald Trump. I mean, he talked about groping women and how, you know, that if you're powerful, you can get away with seducing them, or as he said, screwing them or whatever it is. And in your film, I couldn't believe that he told Alan King to move his chair back because talking to him, he had bad breath.
Well, you know, that's a standard Trump thing. What he is really, really good at is putting you off base. You know, if he does something to disrupt what you're doing, then he takes control of the situation. And it's actually kind of a, you know, gross but brilliant maneuver. And the stories are rampant in business negotiations where he would do things like that. And then he could take control of the situation. It's kind of ugly.
Yeah, it's extremely ugly, and it's totally tasteless and classless. I have two extremely close friends who are to this day extremely strong Trump supporters, and they're indeed very close friends, so I try not to talk about Trump too much. But do you imagine, what do you think would have happened if the public had access to your film before the election? Do you think he would have been president of the United States?
I would like to hope I could have that much impact, but the film was out there. People could see it. We just, couldn't. If the major media doesn't pick you up, it's like a tree falling in the forest, even with the internet and all, you can get attention. And a lot of people have seen the film, but a lot of people also said they didn't care. I did 2 hours of drive time talk radio in L.A. About 6 months into the campaign, and I talked to truck drivers and all sorts of people who said they didn't care. Anything was going to have to be better than Hillary, and anything was going to have to be better than the situation they were in. And people were hurting, and so they heard him say, I want to make America great again. I want to bring the jobs back to the steel mills. All that stuff, and they so desperately wanted to believe. And
Yes, you're right.
Donald is P.T. Barnum.
that he is. But then look at Hillary. If Hillary had access to the film, why didn't she trumpet that? When Bernie Sanders announced, a year at the instant he announced, I was very supportive of him. Emotionally and intellectually, I was interested in a lot of his programs about student loans and putting some bankers in jail and things like that. But I said publicly, this guy's going to turn into the Democrats' Ron Paul, which indeed he did. I wrote a long letter. I used to write for a lot of politicians and famous people, but I wrote a long letter to him saying, if you want to get rid of Hillary Clinton, run that video of her being interviewed talking about Gaddafi. We came, we saw, he died. I mean, she looks reprehensible. She's the Wicked Witch of the North. You run that, and you're the next president of the United States. They never seem to run anything that really exposes how dreadful the opposition really is.
Well, you got to ask why, right?
Yes, and why is that? Is it true? As George Carlin says, they all belong to the club of which we are not a member.
That is so true. And there he is. He's saying he wants to drain the swamp. I mean, the biggest thing that I found out about Donald, and I really did try to get out there as much as I could, is Donald is not an outsider. He is an insider. He has been playing this game since he was a child. His father had the political connections. He inherited the political connections. You don't build Trump Tower with the tax exemption he got unless his father was great friends with the mayor of New York City, Abe Beame. These things go to insiders, not outsiders. And this whole thing that Donald is the great outsider is the biggest scam of all time.
Well, I must tell you, it is a startling film. So before we get to the next bit of this conversation, where can folks see it now, and for how much?
You can go to our website, which is trumpthemovie.com. It's there. You can download it. It's also on iTunes, Trump What's the Deal, but the easiest place to find it is trumpthemovie.com.
And how much do you charge?
Oh, gosh, it depends on what service you have, but you can rent it for under $2.
Yes, and bless your heart for that, because I did the same with my film at $1.99. I made it as cheaply as possible, even though it cost me and Gino Minari a fortune to make, so that everybody would have access to it.
Well, I have to say, John, I've seen your film, and you've done a remarkable job yourself. I mean, all the things you have accumulated are just wonderful. So, everybody watch my film and then watch John's.
Well, that's sweet. That's very, very, very sweet of you, Libby. Okay, now, knowing, your insight, let's go to something other than the Trump movie that you were really proud of. I mean, me as a film critic, I loved the Casablanca thing. I just loved it. And when I watched the baseball thing, reminded me of that wonderful movie that Brad Pitt made a couple of years ago about the Oakland baseball club. I mean, it's really wonderful stuff. What are you most pleased about in the work that you've done?
I think that I'm most pleased with being able to take subjects and have fun with them and try and find a new approach to look at things from. So, you know, on the baseball films, and I can't take credit for the subject matter because my old boss, who then became my mentor and my business partner, who is sadly not with us anymore, was an old Brooklyn Dodger fan. And he could watch baseball games with the sound turned off and tell you what was going to happen and what the manager was going to do. So, you know, the insight really came from him. So to do a film about, you know, violence as a part of the strategy of the game, that really came from him. And so that was a unique twist on baseball and really trying to get the players to talk about what, not just, you know, so it was the third inning and what did you do next, but really think about what was happening on the field. And for example, in another film we did three, and we analyzed the famous passed ball from the 1986 World Series. But not, you know, three things happened there. And it was the middle one that really changed the face of the game. And that's something I wouldn't have known to do, but he did. And so, you know, I appreciate doing different things. And there's another film which I don't think you got a chance to see, but it's called The American Ruling Class, and it's a dramatic documentary musical with Lewis Lapham.
That's, you know, I read about it, and then I saw that it was a musical, and I presume there's a lot of great satirical stuff in it, and I was a huge fan of Tom Lehrer's back in the 70s, and we don't have those troubadours anymore singing those songs. Can these all be seen on Trump the Movie site?
No, they can't, but you can go to theamericanrulingclass.org and you can see that there.
Okay, repeat what it is and what it is about.
Sure, it's theamericanrulingclass.org is the website, and it's a film that tells the story of two young men who are graduating from Yale, and they're trying to decide whether or not they're going to rule the world or save the world. They meet Lewis, and he takes them on a tour of the corridors of power, where they meet everybody from Barbara Ehrenreich, which at the time she had just written her book Nickel and Dimed, and there's a song that derives from that. They meet James Baker, they meet Pete Seeger, they meet all sorts of people. They travel the corridors of power, and it's a really fun film.
What a wonderful way to teach. History. Now, obviously, you're at the peak of your career, and I know that you can't stay much longer because you're off to do something else. What is it that you're planning to do next?
We are doing a film that looks at the last years of the lives of JFK, RFK, Martin, and Malcolm. And that's all I can really say about it right now.
Oh, my God. It will turn out to be a masterpiece. Knowing about how you work and what it is you do with your work. Libby, I want to thank you so very, very much for coming here to doing the show. And I would urge everyone, whether you like Donald or don't like Donald, you will get much more of an insight into this man as a businessman, a faux businessman, but a really brilliant guy who knows how to work the system and use the system. It will give you enormous insights. And that's it. Tell us where it is again.
Sure, it's TrumpTheMovie.com.
Well, Libby, thank you again. And I look forward to you coming back after the year to do the show once again.
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you so much, John. And everybody, go watch John's film, too. It's a great tour de force. Thank you again so much.
Thank you, dear, and good luck tonight. Drive safely.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back with our cohort and a guy that I could not be properly informed about anything without his being here, and that's Joe Satilli. We'll be right back.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing?
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Hi, this is John Barber. Welcome back to John Barber's World live in Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm joined now with my cohort, who I love to talk to every time I do this show. Joe, did you get a chance to listen to Libby at all?
I did, and I figure we could just continue on with the interesting psychology of President Donald Trump, because the last, 11 days, it's been one story after another about Trump coming apart, unraveling, that there's an adult daycare system in place there where they monitor everything he does and they move him in different directions and they hide things from him. There was one story that McMaster, National Security Advisor McMaster, was literally trying to hide the Iran nuclear deal agreement from him so that he couldn't read it and misinterpret it.
It sounds like Peter Sellers.
It is. Well, look, there's so many different analogies. And, you know, you and I, we both love film. And I think, you know, I have my favorite eras of film. I'm a big film noir fan. I do love movies of the 30s. I think the 70s was an apex moment in filmmaking. And you could probably say something about that, because that was a time when you were a film critic and you got to see it. There was so much creativity, but there's some amazing films in the 70s, but being there and Chauncey Gardner or Chance Gardner, who became Chauncey Gardner, I mean, there is some level of that in Donald Trump, because here's one quick thing aside that I just thought was very, very funny. Casey Hunt is the Capitol Hill reporter for MSNBC and NBC News. And she just launched a new show. It was a big to-do, whatever. So they had her to cross-promote her on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd, because you know how incestuous that gets. I got to cross-promote our new property. So she's on there, and she's talking about Senator Bob Corker. And Bob Corker is a Republican senator from Tennessee, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, very powerful guy, widely respected. Maybe not agreed with by everybody, but respected. He's a very measured guy. He was a Trump supporter early on and has obviously fallen away from Trump. Trump has renamed him Little Bob Corker, and that's Little with two D's, right? Two D's.
I saw that video you had on your news channel. God, it's hilarious.
It's hilarious. Okay. Well, he then gets back. He starts tweeting back and saying, you know, well, it looks like some. This is where the adult daycare thing comes. You know, when Trump was tweeting about little Bob Corker, he tweets back, it looks like somebody didn't show up for their shift on adult daycare today at the White House. And great comeback. Well, Bob Corker he's resigning, and he's not resigning. He's not going to run again, which is in effect resigning, because as an incumbent from a state from Tennessee, a Republican, you are resigning, because it's fairly guaranteed that you're going to be reelected, particularly a guy like Corker. And so they're talking about Bob Corker's maneuvering and how he's free now. And Casey Hunt said this one thing. He said, well, what senators have learned on Capitol Hill is that if you want to communicate with Donald Trump, you have to go on TV to do it, because Donald Trump doesn't think you matter at all unless you're on television.
Chauncey Gardner again.
And that's Chauncey Gardner. I mean, it's because Donald Trump's I've said this online many times, that people say, what do you think Donald Trump's main policy objective is? And I say, it's airtime.
So funny.
But that's so true. Does he know anything about healthcare? He does not. Does he know anything about the Iran deal? He does not. Does he know anything about these policies? What he knows is that if he says certain things, he gets a reaction from the news cycle. And the one thing you didn't get to talk to with filmmaker was the way that Donald Trump manipulated his media persona when he was in New York. And he actually created, one guy was called, I think it was called John Barron, and he would call up the tabloids in New York and pose as his own press agent to tout Donald Trump, his clients, even though it was him, tout his clients' sexual conquests so that it would get to page 6 of the Post. And here's the dirty secret, little secret is all of the reporters knew it was Donald Trump pretending to be a press agent representing Donald Trump. And you know, Joan, you asked her.
It's satire.
You asked her if people had seen this her movie about Donald Trump, if they would have not voted for him, if he might not have won. And I think she's right when she says no. I think that you know, there's probably every chance he would have won, because that story I just told you broke in all the major papers. It got cycled through probably.
I remembered reading it about a year and a half or 2 years ago.
And it did not. It didn't appear on Fox News. So that 1.3 million of hardcore voters who only watch Fox News may have been insulated from it. But by and large, people would have been exposed to it at some point. Didn't matter. Didn't care. And I submit to you, John, that in some ways it's because on a deep visceral level, Donald Trump is who we are and who we've become in this reality show, self-promoting, celebrification environment that we're in, where we all kind of feel like we're minor celebrities now on Facebook when people like our posts now. You know what I mean? And because of reality television, we all feel like, well, we could all be stars. And in a way, the American dream is no longer a nice house and a white picket fence and 2.5 kids and a dog and 2 cars and all that. It's being famous. It's being famous. And if you think about the Kardashians, the mother of the family arranged to have a sex tape made with Kim Kardashian that they surreptitiously released and were aghast that was released, but it has been determined that the mother and Kim Kardashian conspired together to make the sex tape and release it so that they would all become famous.
They became famous.
And they became...
And people know about it and still watch it because their outlandishness made them television stars.
Exactly. Now, John, I want to ask you this, because you've rightly been called the godfather of reality television. And I would actually say to you that I think that that's a misnomer, only insofar as what reality television is today is really nothing like the reality television that you were proposing and that you made successful at the end of the 70s, the beginning of the 80s.
Not at all. I almost hate to say that anymore, that
the Godfather of reality television, because people hear that and they look at you with disdain, because it is reprehensible. It is showing humanity at its worst. You know, you don't have to have talent. You don't have to have intelligence. You don't even have to have looks. You can be a midget. They got a show about midgets now, for crying out loud. All you have to do is have a lack of embarrassment.
Yes, that's right.
That's all. I mean, it's just...
If you are shameless, you can be a star. And so, John, if that's where we are as a culture, is not Donald Trump the most representative president we've had in a system of representative democracy over the last 30, 40 years?
There's no question about that. There's no question that he epitomizes exactly what America is today. And the one who predicted it was H.L. Mencken back in the early 30s. He said, one day every American ignoramus will be totally happy because they will elect a president who is an absolute idiot. And I hate to say it, but he is an absolute idiot. He has no class. He has no intelligence. No. There's nothing about him that inspires me. And I say this in spite of the fact that two of my closest friends love him. You know, it's just, if you know what, it's, I've said this to my wife. I never cared for her mother at all. I loved her father, the dearest, sweetest man I have ever met in my life. He was handsome until the day he died of a heart attack at 63. The mother was always reprehensible and uptight, and we spent a fortune on her and gave her gifts when I was rich and famous. But at one time, I said to my wife, if she was your mother, you wouldn't even want to know her. And you know, and it's the same with Trump. Who would want to know a man like that unless... If he were not rich, you wouldn't go near that guy.
No, if he were your boss, or if you were a contractor working for him, he'd be dead to you after a few experiences. And so,
yeah. But the scary thing is this: if he wanted to save his life. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people who, there's a congressman who came out 2 days ago and says when he gets back to his office in Washington, he's going to file articles of impeachment against Donald Trump because he is anti-American. But what is protecting him is it's somebody worse in Pence. If he wanted to save his life, he should have made his vice president Bernie Sanders.
Yeah,
you think they want a socialist in the White House? No, they'd put a Praetorian guard around Donald Trump, and the media would be singing his praises right now.
Well, and I'll tell you, I think you're onto something, because I think one of the reasons why he is where he is and still is where he is the same reason why the stock market continues to go through the roof. Do you know, the stock market is reaching these record highs, and Donald Trump touts it fine. You know, 80% of all of that value that's being created is being hoarded by less than 10% of the people in the country.
That's exactly right.
And they're all, what they are doing is they are gambling in advance of what they think Steven Mnuchin and Gary Cohn, two Goldman Sachs alums, are going to deliver in this tax bill. And this tax reform, which is going to have this estate tax, they love to call it the death tax. We're talking any people who have, you know, $5 to $11 million in assets or more that get passed on. How many Americans have that? So he goes to truckers last week and says, oh, you're all going to be able to hand down your family wealth to your kids now. The government's not going to take it away. How many of those truckers are going to be handing off these massive estates? They're not. So there's that. But there's this thing called pass-through where individuals are going to be able to become corporations, and they're going to be able to, instead of being taxed for having income at the income level and having – Social Security tax and having Medicare and Medicaid taxes and all those payroll taxes that working people have, you're going to become a corporation, and he's going to cut the corporate tax rate, and all of your earnings are going to go through this pass through, and they're all going to have a windfall. So you're going to have all these people on Wall Street who are all of a sudden going to be individuals becoming corporations, and they think that they are going to make big bucks off of this tax deal. So that's one of his constituencies. Another constituency, the defense industry. The defense industry. $700 billion defense bill. That's just the defense bill. We're not talking about the $1 trillion upgrade of nuclear weapons that began under Obama.
That's true. But the worst thing about it is there are no enemies. You know, Ozzy Osbourne, in one of his drug states, he said, they say that guns don't kill people. It's people that kill people. Well, why do they give soldiers guns? Why don't they just send them to war as people? And, you know, if you think about it, if you expand upon that, the United States does not need an army. We have 10,000 nuclear bombs. We have 250,000 rockets and probably 1 million drones that could be armed with rockets. We could kill thousands anywhere around the world. So why do we need soldiers with guns? The only need for soldiers with guns, the only reason for them is you cannot steal the mineral rights and the oil rights and the property in Venezuela or Iran or Afghanistan unless you have an army there to take it over.
Well, or the threat of it. Right.
Or the threat of it. OK, so you literally now a fellow who is a friend of mine, a black teacher, a very accomplished teacher named Garland Brown, posted the other day. He is somebody who is military, and he is offended by all the military showcasing that goes on at football games and on at hockey games. And he said publicly, what would the public feel like if we still had a draft?
Right.
You would not see all this Nuremberg American flag waving if we had a draft, and middle class Americans would be finding their children and their nephews and nieces coming back in body bags. And that's how smart the owners of this country are.
Well, this is one of the unfortunate, sadly, lessons of Vietnam is military planners learned that you cannot sustain unless you actually have a war for existential survival, unless you actually are involved in trying to protect the country from an active invasion on its shores. If you're going to have the kind of military adventurism that became commonplace at the beginning of the Cold War, you can't have a draft. You have to have what we call a professional army. Well, that's historically, right. What are professional armies called? Mercenaries.
That's now, exactly. They're hired killers.
Hired guns.
And there are many people on Facebook that say the reason all of these terrorists in London or Vegas or wherever they are, except for Paddock, all of these people wear masks because they are mercenaries who probably have blue eyes and blonde hair.
Well, so, I don't know about that, but to get back to Donald Trump, you know, there are two interesting things or two interesting links, and it's something called THAAD, THAAD, thermal high altitude interceptor, da, 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 da. It's Lockheed Martin makes it. This is missile defense. For the last 5-6 years, the Obama administration, the Pentagon, could not get South Korea to accept THAAD. They didn't want THAAD. The Chinese didn't want THAAD there because the dirty little secret of missile defense is that it's actually an offensive weapon. Because if you have a missile defense system on the border with an adversary that has nuclear weapons and the missiles to deliver it, you can technically engage possibly in a first strike nuclear war. Because the retaliatory strike could then be knocked down by the missile defense. So missile defense actually makes a first strike possible. And this is what, you know, as you know, John, mutually assured destruction was all, look, we're both going to have the ability to kill each other so that we'll never kill each other with nuclear weapons and the planet won't die in a nuclear winter. Well, because of Trump's saber rattling with North Korea, guess where THAAD is now? It's in
South Korea.
And
well, you know, I'll tell you what.
There's one more. Because now that he's opening up the Iran deal and going after Iran, guess who's just getting on board with THAAD? Saudi Arabia. So what is Donald Trump doing? He is basically acting through his actions as a de facto salesperson for Lockheed Martin.
Yes, indeed he is. And you know, I'll tell you what I've seen more and more. Since Trump started this nonsense with North Korea and he's saying it's a calm before the storm. What storm is he talking about, for crying out loud? He can't even articulate that. As I have seen literally hundreds and hundreds of Facebook comments of people saying, God help us. God help us. Now, when I was preparing, do you mind if I read you a short something?
Oh, please, please.
While I was preparing the show and I was going through a lot of these Facebook things, and I have just fabulously bright informed people as Facebook friends. Thanks God. Thank God. And you're the brightest and the most informed. So thank God for that. And this is coming from an atheist, but I kept seeing that and I kept thinking this thought kept me popping up in my head. And while I was trying to articulate and think of how to introduce Libby to talk about her film, I couldn't get this thought out of my mind. So I sat down at the typewriter, and in 45 seconds, I wrote this. As I do often, it just pours out of me. So you don't mind if I read this short thing to you?
Of course not. Oh, John, to listen to you, what you write is one of the treats in life. So please do.
Okay. It's on my Facebook page. I posted it among all the other really more interesting and radical stuff that I have up there. It's called, and I love it because it reminds me of Mark Twain and his letters to Earth that he never wanted published till after he died. But it says, a short conversation between God and Satan. And Satan says, hey, God, once again, thank you. And God says, for what? And Satan says, well, for letting me hang around for all these centuries. If as the Almighty you'd gotten rid of me, you would prove you are indeed the Almighty. So why didn't you disappear me? And God says, Sate, you mind if I call you Sate? You've already got two more letters than me. And Satan says, not at all. In correct English, God, more than I, not more than me. Jesus, you're getting sloppier than newscasters. And God says, true. That's because I care less and less for humans. And Satan says, why? And God says, because they've been killing one another constantly for millennia with no reason other than greed. And Satan says, my kind of people. And God says, Satan, you know the stupid reason they have for killing each other now? And Satan says, no, what? And God says, because they think differently from one another, because they worship me differently. And Satan says, love it, love them. And God says, well, you can have them. They're all yours now. And Satan says, thank you. Thank you again. My cathedral, the earth, and my parishioners will outnumber swaggerts and all those other phony Christian money gruggers. And God says, but Satan, be careful. And Satan says, about what? And God says, finally, one of their so-called world leaders may want to take your place.
Yeah. So. Yeah. No, that's. No, I think that, John, that's it, right? Isn't that it? Is that the self-aggrandizement, the desire to, you know, here's how I've been framing it. Immanuel Kant, philosopher, 18th century philosopher, came up with something called the categorical imperative. And it's really simple. It's really what it is it's the golden rule. It's in all things, regard people as an end and not a means to an end. And if you are using somebody or regarding somebody as a means to an end, you are probably acting immorally because you're not viewing them as an end unto themselves. They're some vehicle or tool or some way of you getting something for yourself, and it's almost impossible to do that morally. And
you know what's so interesting? You became a brilliant writer and news reporter and journalist because somewhere along the line, when you were growing up, you saw people on television, maybe like Ed Murrow or somebody who inspired you. I got into television because I was inspired both by Jack Parr as an entertainer and by Edward R. Murrow as a newscaster. They moved me. They moved me emotionally. They moved me intellectually. I do not see anyone in America today
who has a broad audience who would inspire anyone.
Or a creator like Norman Lear, because I have to tell you, Norman Lear probably did more to raise me than just about anybody else on this planet.
And you know, he could not get All in the Family on the air today. He probably might be able to get the Red Fox Show on the air. And Golden Girls and Maude were absolutely brilliant, but he could not get All in the Family on the air today because they would not let Archie Bunker talk about Donald Trump the way that the country would want him to talk about Donald Trump.
Well, John, I think in 2 weeks we should continue this discussion. I'd love to talk more about particularly television and influence, but I know we got to go. John, I just want to tell you, it has just been my treat to talk with you every 2 weeks. I look forward to this. I look forward to 2 weeks from today. And folks, go get the film, Second Assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Okay, last word. On the 25th is a Christmas, is a Monday when I ordinarily do a show. I would like to take my last show, which is the 14th, with you and I alone, just doing a recap of the entire year.
Let's do it.
Okay, we will. Thank you so much. Thank you all for listening. And as Ed Murray used to say, good night and good luck, because you're going to need it. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
A sunny, 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 I love you.